This is Puget Sound Now, a closer look at the people and issues across our community. Here's your host, Northwest News Radio's Bill Schwartz.
From Black Friday to Cyber Monday, shoppers are shipping holiday gifts. Beware, porch pirates lurking.
Yeah, 'tis the season for porch pirates, but not on our watch.
Another holiday scam is on the rise, gift card draining. We hear advice from the Better Business Bureau. In a season of giving, four-legged friends give back in so many important ways.
It's an important time to have the benefits that a service dog provides, where you can trust that dog doesn't have a different agenda.
How to train your own service dog through Atlas Assistance. Looking for fun and educational family activities during the holidays? How about Seattle's famous Museum of Flight?
They wanted to preserve the history of aviation of the Northwest. That's how it started.
An up-close look at a Soviet MiG art piece and the original Air Force One. Hello again, I'm Bill Schwartz. Happy to have you along for Puget Sound Now. The holiday shopping season has begun. It's also porch pirate season. Eric Hall says a thief brazenly stole a package from his front porch in Marysville.
He crossed the window, looked at us in the window, and came up on the porch and took a package that I didn't know was up there at the time.
Hall told Como News he reported the theft to the local police department, and in Snohomish County, they've already seen 49 stolen property offenses this year. From Black Friday to Cyber Monday, online holiday shopping is underway. Packages start arriving at your house. Will the Grinch take them away? We hope not. Let's try to prevent that from happening. Porch piracy prevention tips from Elisa Carroll with Amazon. Thank you so much for your time on Puget Sound Now.
Thank you, Bill, and happy holidays to you.
People have already been clicking that mouse, getting their holiday shopping started with Black Friday and Cyber Monday, and packages are arriving, I know, in my neighborhood here in the Seattle area. How do we make sure that the Grinch doesn't take them away?
Yeah, 'tis the season for porch pirates, but not on our watch. Amazon has a number of easy tips for customers this holiday season and all year long. For instance, if you've received a package from Amazon, you probably know that there's a photo on delivery. So delivery drivers will snap a picture of that package when it's delivered, and you get a notification right away that it's on your doorstep. You can also track your package in real time, which is super helpful. So if you've ordered something, you go to your orders page and you can easily see where that package is as it's on its way to your home, even 10 stops out. And then you can also leave a message for a delivery driver. So right there in the memo section on the orders page, you can specify a hidden location so that that package is out of view from anyone passing by.
Folks in my neighborhood have been real good about watching out for each other. How important is that to prevent porch piracy?
It's really helpful. And in fact, you can share tracking details with your neighbors, with your family members, with friends, so that they're keeping an eye on that package when it's delivered, if you are unable to, or if you're not home. So that is a really great feature. I mean, make sure that you've identified where that package might be so that you don't think that it's gone missing because of a porch pirate.
So my Aunt Linda's sending me something from Delaware. How do I make sure that she knows I won't be home on specific dates and maybe she doesn't want to send that package right away?
Well, if you're an Amazon Prime member, you can specify a specific day of the week to have that package or packages delivered at one time so that you can let her know that you'll be home on Thursday and that's when you'd like to have that package delivered in and around that time. There's also a really cool option of a pickup location or Amazon Locker. So we have 25,000 locations across the country where you can very easily and conveniently pick up a package that's been sent to you, even at a Whole Foods market near you.
We have a few of those in the Seattle area, and Amazon's home, so there are some lockers around here. How about setting up video and Ring systems on your front door? Now, I know some people, even that, with those, the crooks are looking right into the camera and saying, I'm taking your package anyway.
Yeah, I know. Opportunistic, right? Ring cameras are great. Porch cameras are really helpful, especially because they do notify you right away if there's somebody on your porch or if something's been delivered. So that can be really helpful. Plus, it gives you a record of what's happened. If that package has gone missing, then you know to, contact our customer service team so that they can assist.
Elisa Carroll with Amazon is our guest on Puget Sound Now. They say this is a crime of nuisance, larceny, but tell me about the cost to the companies involved.
It is theft, and I'm glad you brought that up because we really do, you know, suggest that customers contact the local police department if a package has gone stolen, because it is, you know, it is a crime, and it's a crime of opportunity. But it's really hard to know, you know, how severe it is. We're one of, you know, many delivery providers, and really, in the grand scheme of things, given how many packages are delivered every day, it's a pretty rare occurrence. But when it happens, it can be a real nuisance, like you mentioned. So we just want to be there to support our customers through it if they want a refund, if they'd like to have an item replaced, or what have you. So really just want to be supportive from a customer service standpoint, too.
I know local law enforcement is taking this more seriously. Elisa, and last year we had dummy packages put up on some of the neighborhood porches, and they caught some guys. How is Amazon working with local law enforcement to make sure that, you know, we have these packages delivered on time to the right person?
You know, if we do hear from customers in a particular location where there might be some porch piracy happening, we will connect with the local police department to see what they're doing to assist. And really, just we want to make sure that the customers are calling us so that we can provide the assistance that they need.
Elisa, any other tips to thwart porch pirates and help your delivery drivers stay safe?
Yeah, I would just say the one thing that we'd like to mention is for people to keep their porch lights on this holiday season, just because there's a lot of deliveries that happen in the dark. And it deters porch pirates, but also is a nice safety measure for those delivery drivers. So that they can, you know, so lighting a path to your porch is really helpful and just really appreciated.
I'll splice that one in. Good ideas. Yeah, you're right. It's dark at 4:30.
Dark at 4:30. I know. And so it's really, really helpful and just so appreciated.
So how can we get more knowledge on this? How can we go somewhere to find it online as we're shopping and make sure we're safe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have 10 quick tips available for your listeners and for our customers on aboutamazon.com. It should be on the homepage, and it's a really easy one-stop shop to just see all of the great ways that you can keep your packages safe.
Elisa Carroll with Amazon, thank you so much for these important tips on Puget Sound Now, and have a wonderful holiday.
You too, Bill. Thank you so much.
There's another prevalent holiday crime on the rise this year. It's called gift card draining. 64% of shoppers plan to use gift cards. And last year, conniving crooks ripped off companies and consumers for $200 million. Here's how it works. Fraudsters go into a store. They scan the back of gift cards to gather information. Once the card has been activated with money, that's when scammers swoop in. They take the amount of cash before the buyer can spend it.
It's when scammers actually go to retailers and outlets and they scan with a scanner and they start scanning numbers off the card, leave them there hanging, and then when you go to use it, guess what? It won't work.
Better Business Bureau Vice President Monday Donaldson advises you to take a close look at the cards before buying them. Is the packaging open or a sticker placed over the barcode?
Is take your hand and take your finger and go over the thing and make sure that it hasn't been tampered with at all, that there's not a piece of tape, that if it's a scratch-off kind, if it's already been scratched off a little bit, you don't want that.
Donaldson says if you see or feel a discrepancy with that gift card, let a store employee know about it. After the scammer has access to gift card information, they can make counterfeit cards, shop online, move funds to their own accounts. Another tip from the BBB, don't insert a gift card number into a fake website. It's called phishing. If you have questions about the gift card amount, go to the retailer's website. Empowering people with disabilities to train their own service animals. It is the mission of a nonprofit called Atlas Assistance Dogs. And we hear more from Puget Sound Now's Lillian James.
According to the World Health Organization, 16% of the global population live with a significant disability. However, not everyone has access to service animals. Today on Puget Sound Now, I am joined by Jennifer Kohler, a founding board member and president of Atlas Assistance Dogs. This group is committed to expanding access to service animals. What exactly does Atlas do?
Atlas Assistance Dogs is a nonprofit. We do a few things. First and primarily, we work with people with disabilities to help them train their own dogs dogs as service dogs using only ethical training methods. We also have a full academy to train professional trainers who want to be service dog trainers to put more qualified and skilled trainers out there to help people with disabilities. And finally, we put a lot of effort around education and advocacy, working for disability rights in our communities and helping educate people in a variety of spectrums of the public and private sectors about disability and service dogs.
And when and how was Atlas formed?
So Atlas was formed 9 years ago. It was my father and I, and actually another father-daughter team were the original co-founders. And then quickly it shifted to my father and I, and then we built up our board. And we were founded, we had been involved with a number of other for-profit and nonprofit service dog organizations. And we realized both that there were nowhere near enough dogs available to those who needed them. And we weren't necessarily happy with the way either the dogs were being treated or the people were being treated in some of the other models we saw. We really wanted to have an ethics-driven organization that focused as much on the dog being happy and thriving in the relationship and as the person. And we really wanted to be an organization that put the person first and not just necessarily what was convenient for the organization.
What's the process like to certify a service dog?
So in the United States, there is actually no formal requirement for certification for a service dog. All the protections are under the American with Disabilities Act. And under that, you need to identify as having a disability, something that impacts your life day to day. And that's in the eye of the individual. That's not necessarily about a medical diagnosis for the ADA. And then you have to have a dog who's well-mannered in public, who does at least one task to directly mitigate that disability. And so there is actually no technical requirement for certification. However, the closest thing there is to that would be an organization called Assistance Dog International. Some countries do require their certifications. Others recognize them but don't require. We are in the middle of accreditation with them. They don't have very many owner trainer orgs accredited, so we're pretty excited about that. But the process with us, and this is following the requirements, is that you apply for our program. In the case of our program, your dog has to be at least 14 months of age, be healthy, have a basic foundation of obedience, such as they would have from the canine good citizen, be comfortable in other people and dogs. And then we look at your needs and do you have the support system and capability to work with us coaching you to train your dog? And then we work with you hands-on for 6 to 9 months, typically nine, meeting in person a couple of times a month. Plus there's online courses and other online communities that we provide to support them. And then we work with the client to help them teach the different disability tasks they need, to help them, to teach them to how to self-advocate, how to enter the kind of the various parts of the world that are particular to them, be that work or school or public transit, things that are important to them, make sure the dog is comfortable in all those settings. Then we do what's called a public access test, where we verify they can do those skills safely in public. And then we provide a vest and ID card, and then we maintain that ongoing the entire working life of the team and then off into the next team.
And I saw on your website that you guys also train service dog trainers. What's that process like?
So there, that is fully online, which means people can access that internationally. That program is designed to be done between 9 months and a year. That is for the somebody who has at least a couple of years of professional level experience. They don't have to be working full-time as a service dog trainer or dog trainer, but they should have some solid prior experience. And then we work through recognizing that to be a good service dog trainer isn't just about training the dog. If anything, that's the easiest part. It's about really understanding working with people, understanding disabilities, understanding disability culture and etiquette, understanding a lot about the different kinds of tasks the dogs can do. And then obviously advanced dog training and how to put that all together. And so we have people apply, submit a couple of references, and then we do a Zoom interview. And then once accepted, we have them go through our academy, which is online on an internationally recognized platform. And there are twice a month optional office hours they can call into to have further collaboration. There's Facebook groups. There's a lot of, we really encourage a community of involvement and a community of collaboration. In the service dog world, there's kind of a lot still of people treating training like the secret sauce. Like They don't want to tell you, oh, here's how you train this. And we're really trying to change that. We're really trying to foster a community that wants to help each other.
Yeah. And how can people get involved in supporting Atlas?
So one option is to just go to our website at atlasdog.org and click donate. And there you could pick a monthly or one-time donation. Otherwise, other ways to support, you can click, we have a link there about volunteering, getting involved, sign up for our newsletter.
Why are services like Atlas so important right now, especially?
So in the U.S., in the last census, over 25% of people identified as having a disability. And so that's one in four people. And that number is probably really highly undercounted. A lot of people are also scared to identify as having a disability. Right now, we're seeing that there's a lot of federal protections or things that we have trusted being challenged. And so it's a particularly challenging time for marginalized people. And many people with disabilities also fall into other groups. And so it's really looking at that intersection of race, of gender, of financial access, of disability. It's an important time to have the benefits that a service dog provides, where you can trust that dog doesn't have a different agenda. That dog is just there for you. And also, it may be a time where social services that we rely on, federal funding that we rely on for food and things like that, become unavailable. And so resources are more limited. So even more important to have a helper that could fetch your medication, that could bring your shoes, that can help you up and out of bed when maybe you used to be able to get a caretaker and now you can't.
If somebody is interested in getting their dog trained through Atlas, how can they contact you guys?
So one of the easiest ways is to go to our website, www.atlasdog.org. And there they can just click on looking at client certification or training their dog. They can also email us at info@atlasdog.org. If they prefer to call, they can also call us at 503-893-8080. Look at our site, look at the materials we offer. It's a really huge range of materials tying into animal-human bond, service dog training, fitness, disability, health, service dog selection. So I would encourage people to take advantage of those resources that are there.
That was Jennifer Kohler, a founding board member and president of Atlas Assistance Dogs. I'm Lillian James on Puget Sound Now.
Holiday break for thousands of kids in Washington State just a couple of weeks away. A fun family outing as close as Seattle's Boeing Field. From the original Air Force One to artwork made from a Russian MiG, the Museum of Flight is a must-see for locals and out-of-state visitors. Stopping by Puget Sound now, Ted Hutter, Senior Manager for Public Relations and Promotions at the Museum of Flight. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks, Bill. It's nice to be here.
1964, aviation enthusiasts in town realized, you know, we better save some of these vintage planes and artifacts or they're going to be lost. Is it true that the first official Museum of Flight exhibits were actually at Seattle Center after the World's Fair?
Right. It all began with a trip that a Boeing engineer made to Anchorage. And while he was up there, he saw and he'd heard about this plane in the city dump. And lo and behold, it was a 1920s vintage Boeing Model 80A. So that was the big Boeing airliner of the 1920s. It was the only one still in existence, and it had literally been thrown away. There was one person up in Anchorage who thought, maybe this is worth something. So I'm going to offer them like $50. And if they'll let me just move it off out of the dump. The Boeing guy from Seattle made a deal with the guy who had just recently bought this airplane to save it and said, we need to bring this down to Seattle, really preserve it. And that was kind of the beginning. That's what got the ball rolling to form a collection and then a museum. So they formed the society to restore this old airliner, Pacific Northwest Aviation Historical Society. It all began with pretty much the mission as stated in the title. They wanted to preserve the history of aviation of the Northwest. That's how it started. And they had a storefront space at Seattle Center back in the mid-1960s. And little by little, it grew. They restored that airplane And it apparently traveled around town a little bit to some events, which kind of boggles my mind because it's not a small thing at all. But hey, I guess the streets were wider back then and fewer cars, maybe.
Of course, the production was happening at the Red Barn next to Boeing Field, where many of the artifacts and aircraft are now housed, and you've expanded into one of the great nonprofit airspace museums in the world. How does Museum of Flight make sure we remember the evolution of flight with inventive displays, just like those founders did in the early 1960s?
Yeah, well, it's evolved quite a bit over the last 50-plus years. It's not just the Northwest story. Of course, that's a huge part of it. You know, we're sometimes called the Boeing Museum, but, you know, we have a huge Boeing collection, probably best anywhere, but it's not just Boeing. It's aviation from all over the world, and really looks at the spirit of flight and now into space flight as well. And Seattle is a huge center now in the spaceflight industry. So this is kind of a new direction for the museum to keep contemporary and keep moving forward.
Our guest on Puget Sound now is Ted Hutter. He is the Senior Public Relations and Promotions Manager for the Museum of Flight right there at Boeing Field. Air Force One is in the news lately. A gift from the country of Qatar, or Qatar as some people call it, to the United States of America Defense Department. It's a Boeing-built 747, magnificent. But your Museum of Flight has one of the first presidential jet planes, specially built Boeing 707-153. Tell us about the SAM, the Special Air Mission 970.
Yeah, that's what the so-called Air Force Ones were called back then. It's always an Air Force airplane. So this was known in the Air Force as a Special Air Mission, you know. So when you're carrying VIPs like the president, and at that time they were little more than modified airliners. You know, it's far different from a current Air Force One, which is loaded with special equipment to make it, for offensive and defensive measures and extra space and security measures that really weren't a consideration or even possible on the planes of that size in the early 1960s and late 1950s, which ours dates back to.
Ted, so, what can visitors see when they walk through this special 707? Is it taking them back into history right after Dwight D. Eisenhower?
Oh, yeah. The plane really hasn't changed since then. It's kind of amazing, and I think it's part of the sort of a tradition within the Air Force. They knew they had it first flew in 1959 for Eisenhower, so he was the first president to use this plane. And here's something that has come into that makes it a little more newsworthy, is that we've for a long time been telling people that when Eisenhower took the plane, you know, he was very clear about saying that this is not a flying palace. This is a place of business. And as you walk into it, that is very clear to every visitor that this is not a fancy place. You know, almost the first thing you see is the communications officer's station, and it's just a lot of dials and switches and telephones and radios. And, you know, it looks more like something that you'd see at an airbase than anywhere else. And then the rest of the plane, which, you know, at the time was comfortable and spacious for its day. We look at it now and you would think, you know, this is not an awful lot different from Grandpa's RV, you know. It's maybe a little more space, but, you know, the same kind of, you know, laminate faux wood paneling and things like that. And even though it was only used really as an Air Force presidential plane until about 1962, it was still used by presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. But in 1962, there was a newer version that really came into more of use by the president. So this one was used more by vice presidents and other VIPs on a more regular basis up until 1996. And they kept the interior pretty much the same as it had always been through all those years. So you really are stepping back in time.
We're talking about Seattle's fabulous Museum of Flight. There is a new exhibit coming in called the MiG-21 Project. You talk about throwback aircraft. This actually now is artwork, Ted, transformed from a decommissioned jet fighter?
Yeah, the MiG-21 Project. This is an exciting project, and it's quite a step in a different direction for this museum, or I think any aviation or space museum, in that it's an art project. And it's the brainchild of an artist who's based in L.A. Called Ralph Zeman. And he's originally from South Africa. And it's really the end of a trilogy of art projects that began about a dozen years ago. And he grew up during apartheid in South Africa. So what he has done with his artwork and then working with artisans still in South Africa is that they would take weapons and instruments of oppression and turn them into works of art. And this supersonic jet, the MiG-21, it's a Russian designed jet that goes back to the 1950s. It's the most produced supersonic jet. Something like 15,000 of them have been made, and some are still in use. It's a very robust design, and it carries with it all kinds of stories throughout the world. So it has quite a history to it. But what they wanted to do is that transform it into something that, instead of representing some sort of a weapon, now it is a work of art that is transformed into a symbol of peace and healing. And it's done with this remarkable exterior, done entirely in glass beads. Literally tens of millions of beads cover all the surfaces of this jet. And that's with working with the artisans in South Africa. And it's very much of African traditional beadwork design, too.
Well, a few more moments now with Ted Hutter, who is the Senior Public Relations and Promotions Manager for Museum of Flight. What kind of programs are offered for students, kindergarten through 12? If you come in as a group, if you come in individually, what are you going to learn about aviation and aerospace at the museum?
Well, you can do it a number of different ways. You know, our education office is really the largest department in the museum. Very robust schedule of education events and offerings. K through 12, they're everything from in the school type learning, we come to the school, or programs where students, teachers, school groups come to the museum to participate in a program that may teach them something about aviation or space. You can earn college credits for some of the high school students, or a little more fun, you come for aerospace camp in the summertime, and it's camper fun. It's learn about airplanes, but it's all about having fun at the same time.
On my program, we always offer opportunities for people to make a difference in their community, volunteer. What sort of opportunities does the Museum of Flight have to be a tour guide, a docent?
Oh, tons of opportunities. And we really are dependent upon our volunteers. We have literally hundreds of them doing all those things that you just described, everything from, clerical work to helping out, as greeters and things like that. Docents have special training, so they can talk about literally anything in the museum. The people that restore our aircraft are largely from volunteer corps. Doesn't matter what your interest is, and it doesn't even have to be, you don't have to have an aviation or space background. We'll teach you what you need to know.
Website where people can learn some more, or maybe sign up for a yearly membership?
It's all on our website, www.museumofflight.org.
Museum of Flight, Ted Hutter, many thanks for the visit on Puget Sound Now.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Many thanks to all of our guests. I'm Bill Swartz. We're back again next weekend.
Thank you for listening to Puget Sound Now, a closer look at the people and issues across our community. Listen for new episodes every weekend and download full episodes at nwnewsradio.com or wherever you get your podcast. Puget Sound Now is a public service of Lotus Seattle Corp and is a production of Northwest News Radio, 97.7 AM 1000.